Welcome to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services, a show about coping with getting older ourselves and dealing with our aging parents. If you have questions about how to cope with these stresses, call Scott at 877-960-9960. Now, here's Scott.
Welcome, everybody. Another edition of Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom. I'm sure my listening audience is ballooning tonight because you're all self-quarantining because of the coronavirus. We are thrilled that you're with us. If you're on your way home, because you're not one of those that is self-quarantining, and you're driving on 95, you're listening on 95.9, we hope that you're driving carefully. Be safe. And, of course, on the Treasure Coast, 106.9. Seriously, as it relates to the coronavirus, I know it's a lot of, it's dominating the news. I would just encourage everybody to calm down, wash your hands, take care of yourself, avoid big crowds. We will survive. I promise you we will all survive. But to my show tonight, let me just say these are unbelievably interesting times, regardless of your political persuasion. In the world of politics today, emotions are high, opinions vary and are strong. But one of the questions that is often asked is, should we do away with the Electoral College? And I don't know that that is either a Democratic or Republican thought. There are a lot of people who think we should do away with the Electoral College. And should we? Where do you stand on that? Well, it's obviously a hot-button subject, and tonight we're going to try to give you some more information and ideas and thoughts about that question, so that you may either confirm your opinion, change your opinion, or just learn more about the subject. Constitutional scholar David Hirschberg is here, and he's going to help us, or help you, answer that question. Electoral college or popular vote? Stay tuned for a most interesting conversation. And if you want to pipe in, you can call us at 877-960-9960. Every week at this time, however, I usually give out some support groups going on this week, and I encourage you to go if you need them. So here are three for this week that should be on your radar screen if this applies to you. In the world of Parkinson's, if you are either struggling with the disease or a family member of, or both of you together, there are two support groups for you this week. Tuesday at 11 o'clock at Discovery Village here in Palm Beach Gardens. That's at 11 o'clock. And on Wednesday, also at 11 o'clock at the Brenity in Port St. Lucie. I would allow some extra time because as you go into some of these communities, they are actually going to make sure you're healthy before you walk in. So they're going to take your temperature. But that's Tuesday and Wednesday at 11 o'clock. Tuesday at Discovery Village, Wednesday at the Brenity. If Alzheimer's disease, if you're a family member of someone struggling with Alzheimer's disease, there is a support group in the Boca area on Wednesday at 4 o'clock at Artis at in Boca Raton. And I encourage you to go if you feel that you need somebody to talk to. It's a great support group, and I encourage you to go. But let me tell you a little bit about my guest. I'm going to read his bio because I want to get into this conversation, which in the spirit of full disclosure, he and I prepared last week, and I spent almost 2 hours getting prepared for tonight. We only have an hour, so I don't want to waste time on too much. But David Hirschberg is a graduate of NYU and Harvard Law School. He went to the Columbia Business School Advanced He has the Columbia Business School Advanced Management degree as well. After 8 years as a corporate attorney with New York City law firms, he joined American Express Company as deputy general counsel. Thereafter, he joined Shearson Lehman Brothers, first as senior executive VP and then vice chairman responsible for legal compliance, HR, audit, government affairs, and strategic planning. He finished his business career as head of the corporate legal group at IBM. After retiring, he served on a number of corporate boards and is sole independent director in two bankruptcies. He's read over 50 books and attended numerous seminars and online lectures and continues to do so all about the constitutional era. He is fascinated by the most important event in the history of man's attempt to govern himself. David, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fascinated by the era and very interested in getting started. My normal format is in a group, and it's interactive, and I facilitate what is a discussion. So I think Scott and I are going to try and simulate that with regard to, is the Electoral College still the appropriate way to elect the president? And if not, is a national popular vote the appropriate alternative? Understand that in order to do that, we would need to amend the Constitution under Article 5, which is not easy to do. However, there are a number of proposed amendments in Congress, in committees, trying to push through an amendment to change the Electoral College.
And I think it's instructive for us to explain the amendment process, but I want to keep everybody on the edge of their seats. Mm-hmm. So before we talk about how to change this, if in fact people want to change this, if it is the consensus of the majority that we do want to go from the Electoral College to a popular vote to elect our president, maybe it would help if everybody understood how we got here.
Okay. We got here as the result of the Constitutional Convention in 1887, quite a while ago. And I'll start by acknowledging that the circumstances then were quite different when the delegates met and conceived of the Electoral College. Keep in mind that they not only conceived of the Electoral College, but in the forefront of their mind was not the notion of a democracy. It was the notion of creating a democratic republic, a representative republic. And there were two major components that sort of dictated the ultimate Electoral College structure. One was most of the delegates still cared about state sovereignty. They did not want to relinquish control to the national government or to the national population. Why not the national population? Because there was extreme skepticism about the knowledge and ability of the general population to control what might be the common good. It was not only exemplified by the Electoral College, but did anyone know that originally senators were not directly elected by their state citizens? They were elected by the legislatures because they did not trust their own citizens. And also keep in mind that the citizen base of people who could vote was much, much narrower. No women, no blacks, no Native Americans, and mostly propertied white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. There were unpropertied people who did not have the right to vote. So the notion of this being a democracy and that the magic words, we the people, or one man, one vote, are not to be taken literally.
And of course, over time, what was has evolved and it's changed. And so today, and I'm going to come back to the senatorial direct election of senators because I think that's fascinating and the whole amendment process is fascinating. But you're absolutely right. Well, of course you're right. That's why you're here.
That's not a political statement, by the way.
people lose sight mm-hmm. of the fact that when the Constitution was adopted, it was designed to satisfy a great deal of not just skepticism but distrust amongst the states, and again, the one man, one vote is an enigma. There was no such thing as one man, one vote, because as you said, it was only voting was only allowed or privileged to a few. So, what does the Constitution actually say about the Electoral College and how we get there, and can we expand upon that foundation?
Yeah, it was a state-driven function, and each state was given a number of electors equal to the number of representatives they had in the House, plus two because each state, irrespective of size, had two senators. Just for your information, the minimum number of population that represented one representative in the House was 30,000. So for each 30,000 people in a state, you got one congressman. Obviously, if you do the arithmetic, if you had less than 30,000, you still got one. So the notion that one man, one vote was never, never on their mind. That phrase didn't even exist at the time. It was later evolved from a Supreme Court decision about gerrymandering.
So we haven't discussed this, but was this based on strictly compromise? Was this based on a concept that existed before we became independent and won the Revolutionary War? This is kind of convoluted. How did we get here?
It was literally a contrivance. I don't think there's, I don't know for sure, but there were very few democracies to begin with. There were some state constitutions, but the notion of an electoral college based upon the kind of structure and arithmetic I mentioned, and with electors, mind you, who were going to be chosen, and the electors were supposed to be the elite. They were supposed to know who the candidates were. They were supposed to be more sophisticated and more educated, especially when it came to foreign affairs. So it was a very elitist kind of process that made most of the delegates happy.
So nobody, there was no direct vote for senator. Was there direct vote for congressman?
There were direct vote for congressmen, but notice that it was every 2 years. They wanted them to turn over rapidly. The Senate, which was the much more staid and conservative house, 6 years with more responsibilities. The six-year term meant those people had ongoing power, and they had more power vis-a-vis the president because they could advise and consent on Supreme Court justices, ambassadors, and approve treaties. Clearly, the more important of the houses of Congress, again, because it was more elite.
So, if they were not the, if the senators more important, more elite, more. Sophisticated, whatever the term is. How were they elected back then? How were they chosen back then?
By the legislatures.
Just by the legislatures. Yeah. So it was a popularity vote, not dissimilar to today's popularity vote, but by a very narrow group of people.
Well, one profound difference among a few others I'll mention is that at the time, there were no political parties. So the notion of choosing an elector, and each elector would have his, because there were no female electors, would have his judgment to decide who would be president. Now, very few, if any, electors break the party robotic vote. So what you have, and in an all-or-nothing system, is one state after another either going Democratic or Republican. And there are a few renegades who decide not to follow the party line. But basically, the political party regimen has changed the notion of an elite set of electors making independent judgments.
So there was nothing in the Constitution then, nor is there now, that mandates an elector in the who's about to vote in the Electoral College vote for the popular vote winner?
Oh, no. The notion of a popular vote was not the mission of any of the electors. It was to choose in their own particular judgment who would be president, and it is irrespective of – there was no popular vote for president.
So – for those who have seen Hamilton, which I just saw, it was early on it was commonplace for the person who came in first to be president, the person who came in second to be vice president. I know that changed, and I know that we've talked about it. Maybe we'll have a chance we can talk about it tonight. How did the electors in the Electoral College then? How did they become mandated by state, because it's right. And back then, you had a national vote. That
no, you did not have a national vote. You had state by state votes.
Okay.
That chose electors who would make a judgment as to whom they would vote for. There was no such thing as a national vote, and in each state, the base for people who voted varied from state to state. Some had religious restrictions. Some had property restrictions. Each state, remember, state sovereignty was a crucial element in what happened at the Constitutional Convention.
So, David, if New York, right, Massachusetts had the largest populations, did they impact the if I go back to the Electoral College, and if it was based on the number of congressional seats that you had, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey would have had the largest number. Did they, by sheer force of number, dominate on who was going to be president?
No. They had more electors based on population. But an interesting aside is that if you look at the first five of our presidents, where did they come from? They came from the South. Virginia, Adams, and then Jefferson and Madison and Monroe. And because of the deal that they cut on slavery, where each slave was notionally three-fifths of a person, those states had more representatives, even though the slaves could not vote. So until Lincoln, out of the 16 presidents, I believe 9 or 10 were from the southern states. That's a detour. And only after the Union won the war and slavery was abolished did you get the North and Northeast and Midwest as the country grew. Since the Civil War, how many presidents have come from the South?
I don't know the answer. It's,
the answer is five.
I knew you'd know.
five, only in contemporary times. You have the two Bushes. You have Clinton, you have Carter, and that's it.
Right.
Lyndon Johnson, excuse me.
Right.
And he backed into the presidency.
Right.
So the South had a distinct disadvantage, having nothing to do with the fact that the Electoral College favored blacks because of the census and because of the deal in the Constitution.
So I clearly have a lot more questions, but and I'm not sure that we have before this upcoming break. I'm not sure that we have the time to do this. So is the fight over Electoral College versus popular vote, is that new or has that existed before?
No, it's new is relative in 230 years of history, but it's relatively new. And let's go over the key reasons why it's changed. We are viewed now as a nation until the mid-1860s and after the Civil War. Citizen more or less still thought of him or herself as a citizen of each state. And the other reasons that are more, I think, profound is the level of education and literacy has dramatically changed in the country. So the assumptions about the knowledge and sophistication of each citizen has definitely changed. Communication is widespread. Then it was very limited and difficult, and even transportation. So the general qualitative judgment about the ability of the common man clearly should be revisited.
Right. And we're going to talk about the amendment process. Again, I don't know how you feel, my audience, about whether or not we should elect a president by popular vote or electoral college. But the reality is that changing that is not nearly as simple as we believe it is. So when we come back, we're going to talk about what it would take to change that. And we're going to talk about a whole host of other things. Of course, this is Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older, so is my mom. I am here tonight with David Hirschberg, who is a constitutional scholar who has raised the issue of electoral college or popular vote. It's a fascinating conversation, a conversation that many of us are having, particularly if our guy loses or our guy wins. Right? It depends what side you're on. We're going to talk about some other interesting things as well. So I encourage you to stay tuned because this is a show unlike most of the shows. We're here every Monday night from 6 to 7. If you're a new listener, oh my God, I'm getting older, so is my mom. Talks about issues that confront boomers and their parents. It could be interesting, like tonight's subject, or instructive, like next week's. So we're going to be doing with a cardiothoracic surgeon next week. We can't figure out how to get much further afield than tonight. So we cover a lot of things. If you're a regular listener, you know that that's what we do, and we're glad that you are back. If you have questions for my guests or for me, you can call us at 1-877-960-9960. That's 877-960-9960.
I'm here with Allison from Comfort Care Senior Services. Allison, at Comfort Care, you guys are proud to be a family-owned and operated business.
That's right, Mike. It's myself and my husband, Tino, my sister, Melissa, and her husband, Joe, and my parents, Irene and Scott Greenberg. As you can tell by six family members being able to work together, family is extremely important to us. Our clients often have kids that live out of state or even overseas, and those extended family members want to have the comfort of being able to contact a family member at any time to follow up on how mom or dad is doing. While you are able to reach a family member at any time, our office staff is truly part of our extended family. They monitor the phones 24/7 in case of an emergency and are empowered to make decisions that are in the best interest of the client, because at Comfort Care, it's the quality of care, not the severity of your condition, that determines the quality of life. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620, or visit our website at palmbeach.comfortcare.com. That's palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
Do your parents live in South Florida? We know it can be difficult to be there for them when you live far away. As your parents get older, things can change in an instant. Are you prepared?
Finding a trusted local expert to coordinate and provide care makes all the difference. Eldercare 360 can provide you and your family the proper guidance, support, and resources to assist you and your loved ones with their daily activities of living with healthcare challenges.
As a patient advocate, Eldercare 360 brings together a team of patient-focused, caring professionals with decades of experience. Call us to see how we can help before the crisis at 561-713-1800.
Make Eldercare 360 part of your team. Eldercare 360, patient advocacy, coordination of services, and full circle of care. 561-713-1800.
You might know that one out of four adults over 65 fall and end up in the emergency room each year. What hits even closer to home is that one in 10 adults over 65 fall every hour of every day in Palm Beach County. Hi, I'm Dan Lagani, the CEO and co-founder of Silver Solutions, the on-demand safe living and home solutions company. At Silver Solutions, our mission is to help make your future look different. For over a decade, we've been working with families like yours to eliminate home safety risks so that you or mom can safely age in place. And when it's time to downsize or ready a family home for sale after a loss, Silver Solutions specialists will also help and do the work for you. To find out more, call now to schedule a free home assessment at 1-877-AGE-SAFE. That's 1-877-AGE-SAFE. Or visit us online now at silversolutions.com. Silver Solutions, we make growing older safer and easier for the whole family.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
Welcome back, everybody. We're thrilled that you're with us. We hope you're having a great day, staying safe from the coronavirus, and stocking up on anything that you need, which is probably nothing because the stores are going to be empty soon. You'll be able to come and go as you please. Anyway, on a serious note, though, please, everybody, be safe. Wash your hands. Take proper precautions. Avoid crowds. We need you. We're glad that you're with us tonight. Just be careful. Anyway, tonight, my guest is David Hirschberg. David is an accomplished constitutional scholar. And tonight we're talking about a subject which I know many of us have probably talked about with our friends over the bagel table, One of our social clubs or amongst our families. Should we have the Electoral College? Should we keep the Electoral College? Or should we migrate into the popular vote for electing the President of the United States? Well, of course, we do it by Electoral College because it's constitutionally mandated. If we wanted to change that, we would need to have a constitutional amendment. And a lot of people think that's easy to accomplish, but nothing could be further from the truth. So, David, I know you and I have spoken about this. Maybe we could explain to the audience what the process of the, what the amendment process to the Constitution is, because people think it's a lot easier than it is.
Okay, let me try and summarize this as concisely as I can. It requires a two-step process. Two-thirds of the Congress and two-thirds of the states in order to ratify a proposal, and then you need three-quarters of the Congress and three-quarters of the states in a convention in order to adopt a new amendment. There have been 27 amendments to the Constitution since 1787. I don't know if that strikes you as a lot or a little, but let me sort of bisect them and give you an over-the-top view. The first 10 were the Bill of Rights, and they were sort of part of the deal during the ratification process because the original Constitution did not have a Bill of Rights. In order to get it ratified, Alexander Hamilton, James Mason, and others said, yes, the first thing that Congress will do was adopt a Bill of Rights. There were originally 12 that were on the table. Only 10 were adopted, and there was no other important amendments absent the two that affected the way the president got elected right after the first Congress. The next series of amendments were the three post-Civil War amendments. So you go from 27 minus 10, which is the Bill of Rights, down to 17. Two were taken away by the procedural ones about the president. Three more were only approved because the Union won the war. If it hadn't won the war, then those 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments never would have been adopted. That leaves 12 left. The remaining 12, two you can throw away because it was about abolition, excuse me, the prohibition, and then back to alcohol. So that leaves you 10 more. Out of those 10, some very important ones were adopted. Women finally got the vote, believe it or not, as late as 1919. The Senate was moved from election by the state legislatures to direct election by their citizens of the state, and age 18 for voting, the income tax in 1913. But it took a while. Think about how difficult it might have been. Women didn't get the vote until 1920 in this country. So,
when people say we should just amend the Constitution, using your analysis just now, in effect, we've had 10 real amendments in 230 years.
If you want to make that qualitative judgment about my arithmetic, yes.
So using your arithmetic. And then today, it still requires, as you said, two-thirds, two-thirds.
Three-quarters.
And then three-quarters.
Right.
I mean, we can't agree on anything in this country. What's the likelihood of that actually ever happening?
Well, it really depends on the political complexion, in the first instance, obviously, of Congress.
Right.
And at one point, the House, quite a few years ago, did pass an amendment to get rid of the Electoral College. It was killed in filibuster in the Senate. Right. So it really depends on the political makeup, and not just at any single point in time, because it's a process. It may take years to get through Congress, and over the course of subsequent years, it works its way through each state. And if each state changes from time to time, you can't predict how any particular set of states will vote. So it's a difficult
and is there a time limit on from beginning to end how far because I know, for example, the Equal Rights Amendment it lasted quite a while until it was passed, and I don't really know this, but I seem to recall that some states that had ratified it reconsidered perhaps not ratifying it, and consequently it could have failed after having passed.
The Equal Rights Amendment was based for women's rights.
Right.
And it took a very long time to get to the necessary number, which was 37. Someone made a mistake and put a time limit in the original congressional proposal, and the 37th came out afterward. And everyone said, well, let's go to the courts. Let's waive that particular provision. And of all people, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who of all people is as pro-woman as anyone, said, you know, that's not going to work, because out of the original 36, five have retracted their vote. Right. So the arithmetic will no longer work. It's a very time-consuming and unpredictable process, obviously.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. Talking tonight about the Electoral College. Yay or nay on the Electoral College? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Should we or should we not continue the Electoral College? Or should we switch to being in favor of one man, one vote, popular vote winning? That, as you just heard, is not as simple as we all believe it to be. We're going to talk more about how the popular vote really is its own problems as soon as we come back. If you have questions for my guest, David Hirschberg, a constitutional scholar, feel free to call us, 877-960-9960. That's 877-960-9960.
I'm here with Tino from Comfort Care Senior Services. Tino, you train all of your caregivers on how to deal with those who are struggling with Alzheimer's disease, right?
I do, Mike. This disease process is frightening for everyone, and change is the scariest thing for most people. Where we should start is changing the way we think. People are not dying from Alzheimer's disease. They are living with it, and we have to figure out a way for them to keep on living their best life possible. I always say activities of daily living keep people alive. Meaningful activities is what gives people a life worth living. Properly training caregivers on all sorts of dementia is very important. Learning about behavior modification techniques, avoiding triggers, tapping into the abilities that are preserved the longest with people with dementia, and figuring out what's important to them are all vital tools caregivers need to understand. Remember, it's about the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines their quality of life. Let our family take care of your family. Call us at 561-630-1620 or visit us on the web at palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
I'm here with Allison from Comfort Care Senior Services. Allison, at Comfort Care, you guys really look at every client differently.
Activities of daily living keep people alive. Meaningful activities give people a life worth living. That's why at Comfort Care, we complete a social history for our clients. It taps into one's life story to help caregivers know more about who this person was and, quite frankly, still is. It asks questions like, what did you do for a living? What volunteer work did you do? What was your favorite book or movie? Were you in the military? And the list goes on. Understanding background like this is helpful in creating meaningful activities. For example, if someone was a cartographer in the Army, perhaps a trip to the library to look at old maps of where they were stationed might be an interesting activity. If someone were an avid golfer, perhaps a makeshift putting green might be a fun outing. We couple that with a day in the life, which asks more of the daily routine questions, so a caregiver coming in is already familiar with the schedule. It makes the adjustment to having a caregiver that much easier. Caregivers want to help their clients live their best life possible. Being armed with the right information can help, because at Comfort Care, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines your quality of life. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm here tonight with David Hirschberg. And if you think that getting the general population to agree on a popular vote instead of the Electoral College, we can't even agree around the table about some basic, we can't agree as a nation about changing the clocks. Anyway, I'm here with David Hirschberg tonight. I'm excited that he is here. We are talking about the popular vote versus the Electoral College in the election of our president. And David, let's get right into it. The popular vote isn't as simple as it sounds, is it?
Well, first, let's let's put it in some context. In how many of the elections that we have had, presidential elections, has this occurred where you have a popular vote that did not align with the electoral vote?
Well, a couple. I mean, there's, right? Right. Gore, Hillary. Yeah.
Right.
There's got to be another one I'm missing.
There's five. Yeah. One of them was in 1824 when there were four candidates. Keep that number in mind because right. it's going to be an interesting hypothetical. And it went to the House of Representatives. And then in the post-Civil War time, when the Ku Klux Klan and others suppressed the black vote in the South, it also happened. So it really is an outlier in terms of what's been happening in this country. But, of course, the two most recent are in the forefront of everyone's mind. But let me ask you, do you know how close the national popular vote has been in very many of the elections?
Well, I know this because we talked about it before before tonight's show, but my audience doesn't
okay,
know.
Okay, so let me answer the question rhetorically. There were eight national popular votes, if that were the basis, where they were settled by less than 2% of the national population. Does that sound like a lot? It doesn't to me. If we had a national vote, think of Florida in all the other 49 states. If you lost the national popular vote by 1%, wouldn't the first thing you do is say, I want a recount? You bet you would. There's millions and millions of dollars at stake and power of the most powerful nation in the world. How do you think we could handle in this country a recount of every ballot in every state?
So it would be a challenge, and I understand that. But I think the problems, that's a real problem. They really are. But a problem that you pointed out to me, which is true, and I'm going to guess it was true in Gore's time too. But even in Hillary did win the popular vote over Donald Trump, but she did not. She won a plurality, but she did not win a majority.
That's a different issue.
And that's even for me a more complex issue.
Well, right? Let me dig deeper in the process issue of a recount. The Constitution provides that the manner and time and place of elections will be exclusively determined by the states.
Right.
And within each state, what do you have? A sort of delegation down to counties, to villages, to cities. Tell me if you have confidence that Florida was the only place where you saw the inefficiencies and corrupt nature of the count. It goes on in every single state. And if every single vote is important, how in the world are we ever going to accomplish that? You may ask yourself, if this were a national election, wouldn't it be behooved us to have the Constitution or Congress prescribe for every single election the manner and time and place of an election? That would make sense, but it ain't in the Constitution. To do that, Congress could, but it hasn't.
The problems you describe, you know, even in today's world, are serious. I mean, look at what happened in Iowa and in Nevada. And last I heard, we still don't have the final count out of California
week. No, we don't. Ever mind you, that's the primaries.
Just the primaries.
That's
right.
Not the electoral process that's required under the Constitution. It's just the primaries, and each party is responsible for the circumstance of whatever mishaps take place.
And this audience in particular, it's never more appropriate to have this conversation than with these the people listening to this show between the hanging chads and and all of the other thing. And you're right about 1%. Our governor is governor by less than 1% and vote this year. And, you know, there's a lot of people who think that was clearly not necessarily fully kosher.
remember the rancor that evolved out of Bush versus Gore, right?
Right.
I mean, forget the difficulties with the process. Think about the mentality of our population.
Right.
For over an extended period of time, we now have a little but too much venom in our politics. Can you imagine how the discourse would turn poisonous if there was a 1% or even 2% demand on recount? It would be horrible.
So it would, and then you throw in the third-party candidates, and we'll come back, and we're going to talk about an interesting three-party race that this is really applicable to.
Not just three. With a national popular vote, you could have three, four, five. Are you going to require a majority to win? And if you are, what's the likelihood of there ever being a majority if you have more than two or three candidates?
And we're going to see the impact of that perhaps at the Democratic convention this year, because there's going to be two people, who neither one of whom might have a majority. But anyway, that's tomorrow's conversation after the vote tomorrow. If you're just tuning in, this is Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. I am here tonight with David Hirschberg, who is a constitutional scholar. And if you've been listening, perhaps you began this show with a strong opinion about the Electoral College staying as it is or switching to a popular vote. And maybe, just maybe, you're rethinking the opinion you came into this show with. And if that is the case, I'm thrilled, because that's the purpose of the show, is to get you to think about issues that may confront you and or your parents or your kids for now and in the future. If you have questions for David, you can call us at 877-960-9960. That's 877-960-9960.
So many things in life get better with age. Just ask anyone who's become a grandparent. But the stress that comes from managing all the details of a home downsizing or move to assisted living is definitely not on the list. I'm Dan Ligani, the CEO and co-founder of Silver Solutions, the on-demand safe living and home solutions company. When it's time for you or a family member to downsize or relocate to an assisted living community, call us at 1-877-AGE-SAFE. That's 1-877-AGE-SAFE, or visit us at silversolutions.com. For over a decade, we've handled every type of downsizing or relocation, from local to national. Let us handle every detail of your move from beginning to end. We'll even help you dissolve your current home or apartment. Call us now at 1-877-AGE-SAFE, or visit us at silversolutions.com. Silver Solutions. We make growing older easier and less stressful for the whole family.
Do your parents live in South Florida? We know it can be difficult to be there for them when you live far away. As your parents get older, things can change in an instant. Are you prepared?
Finding a trusted local expert to coordinate and provide care makes all the difference. ElderCare 360 can provide you and your family the proper guidance, support, and resources to assist you and your loved ones with their daily activities of living with health care challenges.
As a patient advocate, ElderCare 360 brings together a team of patient-focused, caring professionals with decades of experience. Call us to see how we can help before the crisis at 561-713-1800.
Make ElderCare 360 part of your team. ElderCare 360, patient advocacy, coordination of services, and full circle of care. 561-713-1800.
I'm here with Scott Greenberg from Comfort Care Senior Services. Scott, you're very involved when it comes to the senior community.
That's right, Mike. We firmly believe that involvement in the community, giving back to the community, comes back to us in many, many ways. One of the ways it comes back to us is in our understanding of what's going on, what's new, what's trending. So we're very involved in the guardianship community, for example. We're involved in Alzheimer's community care, in the Alzheimer's Association, in Parkinson's. We run support groups. Basically, what I'm saying is that we want to be a part of the community in ways that we just don't receive benefit, but that we can
give benefit as well. It's very important for us to understand the needs of the entire community and the needs of other people who are providing services. It is only through that that we can ensure that we provide the best care possible. Remember, Mike, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines the quality of their life. So remember, let our family take care of your family and call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620, or look us up on the web at palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, and So Is My Mom, with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
Welcome back, everybody. Yes, indeed. Scott Greenberg, Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom. I'm thrilled that you're with us tonight. If you're a regular listener, thanks for staying with us each week. If you're new, we're here every Monday from 6 to 7. We talk about issues that are of interest and are important and concerning, perhaps, sometimes to boomers and their parents. Tonight, we're just having a fun conversation about something that probably isn't fun all the time, and that's politics. We're talking about Electoral College versus popular vote. Should we switch from Electoral College to the popular vote? And it's not as easy as yay or nay, as if you've been listening, you have found out. But David Hirschberg is here. David is a constitutional scholar and clearly knows his stuff, if you've been tuned in. David, the one man, one vote, the problems that we've been talking about, they're real, right? The problems are real.
They're real. But let's analyze how the process would change if we did have one person, one vote. How many times do you think that the winner of the presidential elections has won the majority of the popular vote? There have been, just so you know, 58 elections for the presidency.
So I don't know how many have won the majority of the vote.
Only 19.
Wow.
Okay, so you got the whole other 58 minus 19 universe, including 2016, where Hillary only won 48% of the popular vote, and he won 46 or 47, and you had these two satellite people floating there, absorbing votes. But let's take a more concrete example in recent memory. What do you think the popular vote that Bill Clinton had when he won in 1990?
I do know because we talked about it, but tell the audience.
Okay, he had 39% of the popular vote. Perot had either 11 or 12%, and most speculate with some sound basis that most of it was taken away from
Bush. Right.
So here you have
a person who won
39%. But times have changed, have they not? If you had a national, by the way, Clinton had the electoral votes, even with only 39%. But if you only had the national popular vote as your mandate, what number would you say would be the required amount that the winner should have?
You know, of course, you've challenged me the two times that we've had this conversation. Me personally, you've challenged me to come up with an answer. And the answer is I don't know the answer because it's impossible.
Well, you better come up with something.
Right. Well.
Can you imagine Bloomberg, who can fund that? Let's take a look at some of the profound implications of money in politics. You had two billionaires who $1 billion was the equivalent of a nickel, Tom Steyer and Bloomberg, both of them without any other financial support, threw their hat in the ring.
Right.
But let's do the arithmetic and say there are four or five candidates, and the top two or three are in the low to mid 30s. What are you going to do? Are you going to give the guy or lady with 33% over the person with 32%? talk about another recall and not even have anything close to a substantial consensus in the country as to who should be president.
And there's no question that that's more than valid. It's absolute. The other side, and it's not really the other side, the thing that some people talk to is that, in, for instance, in California, and everybody thinks nobody wants California to set the tone for everybody, but the truth is that population per electoral vote in California is infinitely greater than the population in Idaho or Montana.
Most importantly, Wyoming.
Wyoming, right? Wyoming. So
thousands
of
thousands.
700,000 people to an electoral vote. Mm-hmm. I'm making the number up. 700,000 electoral vote in California and 100,000 people in Wyoming. And so who gets greater representation? The smaller, more rural states get a disproportionate percentage, and that tends to upset people who are advocates for the popular vote. And your point is more than well taken. I mean, the Perot example is brilliant, right? I mean, it spells it perfectly. So then the answer is there an alternative?
There are a few alternatives, one within the notion of a national popular vote, which is ranked voting. When you vote, you don't only put your first choice down, you put your second and your third, or however you want to rig it, and then depending upon who comes in first, second, or third, and then if there's no one with close to a majority, let me assume you got to get to a majority if you're going to have ranked votings. Can you imagine the negotiating and deal-making that would take place if the winner had 33% and there was a 32% and a 31%? What would go on behind the scenes in terms of the counting of who would win what?
It's so important. Just by way of validating the conversation we're having tonight, not that we need to do that, I voted yesterday here in Florida by absentee ballot. And the ballot came, and there had to be 15 or 16 choices on the ballot. Now, with early voting, vote by mail, absentee balloting, I know a number of people who voted before people pulled out on Super Tuesday. So their votes either don't count, right, because they voted for one of the 14 who are no longer there instead of the two who still are. So we really have an election in Florida primary a week from tomorrow for two people, and yet there will be votes for 16 people. Mm-hmm. And it just validates the insanity of our process. But I think the insanity of our process is highlighting the need for us to come up to some solution. And I want to talk about two states that have done something, and I will in just a minute. If you just tuned in, of course, this is Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom, here every Monday night from 6 to 7 on 95.9 True Oldies, 106.9 on the Treasure Coast. We're thrilled that you are with us, particularly if you're new and just found us. We talk about a whole host of interesting subjects every Monday here on Oh My God. If you tuned in late, or you tuned in for the sports show and you're sorry you missed the beginning of this show, the good news is you can listen to it anyway, because we're going to podcast it tomorrow. Yes, we are. It's going to be up and running sometime around noon. You just search OMG, I'm Getting, on all the podcast platforms, and you can find us. Of course, if you're not a podcaster, and I'm not, so I understand, you can go to our website and listen to this show or any of the other 320-odd shows that we've done. PalmBeach.comfortcare.com. PalmBeach.comfortcare.com. C-O-M-F-O-R-C-A-R-E.com. Don't put a T in there as much as you want to, as much as spell check tells you to. Avoid doing that. You will not find us. Wherever you are, you can listen to us, because we're on iHeartRadio. 95.9 True Oldies is on iHeartRadio. Just download the iHeart app, select 95.9 True Oldies, and there we will be every Monday. And, of course, we simulcast locally around the country, around the world, in fact, on TrueOldiesFLA.com. This is Heart Month, and next week we're going to talk about your heart and heart health with Dr. Jeff Newman, who is a cardiothoracic surgeon from Delray Medical Center. I'm really looking forward to talking to Dr. Newman. He's a wonderful guy. It's a lot of new developments, both in surgery and other places where heart health matters, and heart health does matter because it is still the leading cause of death, heart disease is. So Dr. Newman's going to help you avoid that outcome. In 2 weeks, we're going to be talking to Dr. Chadwick Hampton. He was a guest about a year ago, and he talked about the Navio robotic surgical procedure. We're going to talk about that and others. Dr. Hampton was a great guest. I can't wait to have him back. He's terrific, so we're looking forward to that. But in the few minutes that I have left with my guest, David Hirschberg, who is a constitutional scholar and has helped us navigate the confusing decision or conversation about the Electoral College or the popular vote selecting our president. We've outlined, David, a whole host of these problems. There are some states that are looking at this differently, right?
They're not just looking. They have, in fact, adopted it. And by the way, going back centuries, all or nothing in terms of allocation of electoral votes was not the standard. It grew over the centuries to become, in 48 of the states, all or nothing. And that's why you had what you had in Florida. But Maine and Nebraska have a different system. They proportionally allocate the electoral votes based upon the popular vote within each state. So if Maine has 17 electors. Remember, that would mean they'd have 15 Congress people, which, of course, is way too many, plus the two senators.
You've been in Maine.
Plus the two senators. And the vote was 60-40 in favor of candidate X over candidate Y. Then the electoral votes would be allocated 60% to candidate X and 40% to candidate Y. And that's a decision made by the states. It cannot be, absent, I believe, an amendment, mandated by the national government. So what would have happened in Bush-Gore? Even if it weren't all or nothing, the whole issue might have been academic because all of the other states would have counted their votes differently because all of the other states, absent Maine and Nebraska, had all or nothing, irrespective of the margin of victory by the one who got all.
It's a fascinating conversation. Do you have any hopes that we're going to get anywhere soon?
Once again, it comes down to politics at a time when politics is at best competitive and at worst hateful and obstructionist. So depending upon who controls a particular state at any particular point in time, they're going to look out for where they have the most leverage, if you will, in a particular election. Now, the so-called swing states, I don't know how they would think about which way they would want to go because they have all of this attention and money spent on trying to influence those swing states. And those swing states, depending on how they go, ultimately get more benefits from the government that has won the election.
And of course, it goes without saying that even swing states are starting to swing both ways.
Yeah.
The world is evolving and it's changing, and there are no simple solutions. And the winds change. We talked about the Equal Rights Amendment as an example. The reality is that there is no simple answer to this question. And so I know you wanted to ask me what I believe, and I don't know what I believe. I would ask you what you believe, and I know you won't tell me. But to my audience, I hope that you or at least had your eyes open tonight to looking at the question about Electoral College versus direct voting for the president. at least look at it a little differently with a lot more knowledge. So, David, I can't thank you enough for being here tonight. You're always an interesting guest. I know you're going up north soon, so I hope you'll come back next year. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about another subject, which is why we only have 435, well, why we have even 435 members of the House of Representatives. But you're a great guest. You've given out wonderful information. You're very engaging, and you make us challenge our preconceived ideas, and for that I thank you. So
that's what I try to do.
I appreciate it. This is, of course, Scott Greenberg. Oh my God, I'm getting older, so is my mom. We are here every Monday night from 6 to 7 talking to you about issues that confront boomers and their parents. Tonight we talked about something really fascinating, unlike anything we've ever done. Next week, Dr. Jeffrey Newman from Delray Medical Center, cardiothoracic surgeon, will be my guest because, after all, it is Heart Month. So to the rest of you, stay safe, keep washing your hands, stay away from crowds, take it easy. We'll see you next week. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. Good night, all.